Marie Therese's ascension to power was a watershed moment in the history of Europe. The Habsburg dynasty had dominated Europe for 300 years, creating the first empire upon which the sun would never set. They had monopolized control over the office of Holy Roman Emperor, a title which only confirmed their preeminence over all other European sovereigns. Having weathered threats from France and the Ottoman Turks, for 40 years following the 1683 siege of Vienna, Habsburg armies, under their generalissimo Eugene of Savoy, cut a path of glory from Belgrade to Brussels. With the exception of the loss of Spain, the Habsburg domains in Europe had reached their territorial apogee. Despite their success, these gains proved ephemeral once the great generalissimo's star began to fade. Marie Therese's father, the Emperor Charles VI, proved incapable of defending the empire's extensive boundaries. His domain entered a decades-long phase of paralysis and contraction. As the army withered and suffered catastrophe in the Balkans, Charles focused his efforts on culture to elevate the grandeur, the legend of his dynasty. Never were the Habsburgs quite as exalted as when they were on the cusp of extinction. Marie Theresa was a female heir in lands where female inheritance was unprecedented. Charles had toured the courts of Europe and his own domains, attempting to sell his pragmatic sanction, a sanction that would confirm his daughter's right to succeed him. The Ottomans and France had recovered from their defeats at the hands of Eugene. Austria's ally, Britain, had demanded the closure of Charles's colonial enterprises in China, the Ostend Company, while her other ally, Poland, Saxony, was the sick man of Europe. Austria's European and German rivals circled the empire like vultures. When Charles VI died, the male line Habsburg dynasty died with him. The Habsburg realm, this composite of anachronistic, multilingual, multicultural units, might simply have disintegrated, to be partitioned in a manner similar to Poland some decades later. Political cartoons of the time even showed items of Maria Theresa's clothing being stolen away, alluding to the loss of Habsburg provinces. An even more dramatic depiction showed her being raped by the French Prime Minister, Cardinal Fleury. Yet the Habsburg realm did not disintegrate, and the female line Habsburgs, the descendants of Maria Theresa, would rule over a European great power until the end of the First World War. Marie Theresa would be glorified ever after as the Landesmutter, the mother of the Austrian nation. Marie Theresa, born in 1717, was the second child of Holy Roman Emperor Charles VI by his wife Elizabeth of Brunswick. Her birth came amidst a period of great sorrow for the dynasty. Her brother, the Archduke Leopold, had died 6 months before, and Mary Theresa's sex was a great disappointment. As it so transpired, Archduke Leopold's death snuffed out all hope of a male successor, as the imperial couple would go on to have two more daughters. Nevertheless, Mary Theresa's position as heir was immediately established over the rights of her cousins, thanks to Charles's pragmatic sanction of 1713. Marie Theresa in the view of her contemporaries, was significantly more attractive than her Habsburg ancestors. She lacked the exaggerated features and famous drawl of her father and grandfather that earned him the nickname Hogmouth. Instead, her fair complexion, blonde hair, and large blue eyes bore closer resemblance to her mother Elizabeth. It may have also helped that Mary Theresa was not the byproduct of the infamous Habsburg practice of cousin marriage. Despite her status as her father's heir, and that her father would spend most of his reign attempting to shore up the succession, she did not receive the excellent education and experience in government demanded for her tenuous position. Instead, she was instructed in etiquette, music, and dance, all the skills intended to flatter a future husband and befit the role of Empress Consort. Charles had intended her to succeed, but not to be a sovereign in her own right. Such responsibility, in his mind, would fall on her future husband. The main candidate for her hand was the future Charles III of Spain. Though he was not expected to inherit the Spanish throne at that time, a marriage between Mary Theresa and Charles would have placed their children in the line of Spanish succession, a thought that terrified both the British and the French. The emperor was not willing to entertain an ambitious marriage proposal that would have jeopardized the pragmatic sanction, and so Maria Theresa married Francis Stephen, the Duke of Lorraine. Though a match with Prussia's Prince Friedrich, later Frederick the Great, would have made Austria's position in Germany much stronger, it was imperative for the future of the dynasty that the future emperor be Catholic. To be Habsburg is to be Catholic, after all. Though I like to consider the earth-shattering implications of Mary Theresa marrying either Charles or Friedrich for the course of European history. Francis Stephen, who had been forced to exchange the Duchy of Lorraine for Tuscany, had the virtue of being utterly adored by the Empress. Though Mary Theresa was marrying in part for love, Francis Stephen was content to use her, the greatest heiress in Europe, as a vehicle for his grand ambitions. Francis was an unfaithful husband, the most prominent of his mistresses being the Princess Oersperg. As the former Duke of Lorraine, Francis was the object of the Austrian court and population's absolute loathing of everything French. Charles VI's court seemed to be predicated on hostility towards the French courtly ways. He was viewed as a coward and a spy. Though Marie Theresa was now the Grand Duchess of Tuscany, her father's fear of his own mortality kept her in Vienna, ready to assume her inheritance at a moment's notice. A pragmatic sanction was not simply a means to guarantee a female succession, but a pivotal document that helped quantify the very nature of the Habsburg realm. Prior to the reign of the Emperor Leopold, there were various Habsburg branches, in Spain, most obviously, but also within Austria itself. Leopold was a descendant of the Emperor Ferdinand II from a junior branch of the dynasty that ruled in southern Austria or inner Austria. The benefit of the demise of so many Habsburg males meant that for the first time since Charles V, the realm was ruled by one man, a fact that Leopold enshrined in law to prevent his sons dividing the empire in Austria. A pragmatic sanction defined the Habsburg possessions as one indivisible domain. It is from this that historians have devised the term the Habsburg monarchy. Previously, the kingdoms of Bohemia and Hungary were elective monarchies, but the sanction ensured some form of hereditary succession and later female succession. The benefit of having so much territory not under Salic law was that female succession was hypothetically possible in a way that was inconceivable, for example, in France. The practice of female rule was common in the Habsburg domains, as relatives of the emperor were often granted domains to rule over as vicereins. Maria Theresa's aunt, Maria Elizabeth, was the governor of the Austrian Netherlands, to name just one example. Nevertheless, There were intractable issues that imperiled the succession and limited the pragmatic sanction's utility. The office of Holy Roman Emperor was not just a mark of international prestige for Austria and the Habsburg dynasty, but granted the Habsburgs suzerainty over Germany, the Reich institutions, the regions with imperial immediacy, like the free cities, and the loyalty of the imperial knights. Though these powers were increasingly theoretical following the Thirty Years' War, the Habsburgs had jealously guarded their privileges for 300 years. Though the emperorship was technically elective, women were not eligible for the office. Only a husband or a son of Mary Theresa could obtain it. Then there was the issue of Charles VI prioritizing his own daughters for the succession. In the secret pact of mutual succession agreed during the reign of Leopold, Charles had settled on the principle that the daughters of his elder brother Joseph would inherit first. What is remarkable about the pragmatic sanction is that Charles effectively disinherited his nieces before Mary Theresa was even born. This gave Maria Josepha and Maria Amalia, the daughters of the Emperor Joseph I, arguably a better claim on the Habsburg monarchy than Maria Theresa. What compounded this issue even further was that both women had married powerful princes in the Holy Roman Empire, the electors of Saxony and Bavaria, respectively. Charles of Bavaria used his wife's claim to get elected emperor. Consequently, Maria Amalia got to be empress before Maria Theresa. Charles VI's solution for this conundrum was to acquire for Maria Theresa scraps of paper, notes offering promises by European powers to recognize the succession. I call them scraps of paper, as they didn't stop many kingdoms from dramatically reneging on their promises, most notably France. The most consequential of these scraps of paper were the treaties of Vienna, which confirmed Great Britain as an ally of Austria at the great cost of the loss of the colonial Ostend Company. The alliance gained with Saxony, whom I've already mentioned was in the best position to contest the will, led Charles into the disastrous War of Polish Succession, in which Austria lost Naples and Sicily to Maria Theresa's former suitor, Charles of Spain. Even prior to his death, the Empress' plan was already unraveling. France agreed to the sanction with the acceptance of Lorraine as a French vassal state, a loss to Francis Stephen, the husband of Maria Theresa. Charles had effectively conceded the loss of an ancient duchy of the Holy Roman Empire, the successor of Lothringen, which was once the imperial epicenter. In my view, this undermined the position of Austria as the protectors of the empire, and Francis Stephen's own viability as a future emperor only a couple of years before Emperor Charles's death. Against Francis's weakened claim was pitted the Bavarian House of Wittelsbach, a dynasty older than the Habsburgs, who had once held the position of emperor in the Middle Ages. Disaster might have been averted had the 55-year-old emperor lived a little longer. Charles's grandson, the future Emperor Joseph II, was born in 1741, just a year after the former emperor's death. At the death of Charles, the treasury was empty, and the army was in shambles. Charles has spent the last decade of his reign fighting useless wars against France and the Ottomans, both of which Austria lost. In hindsight, we can say that what Mary Theresa needed was hard military power, not paper promises. Mary Theresa was forced to fight for her realm in a conflict known as the War of Austrian Succession. The foreign powers reneged on the sanction. France, Spain, Prussia went to war against Austria. The Saxons and the Bavarians staked their claims against Austria for the imperial crown. Charles Albert of Bavaria, husband of Maria Amalia, Theresa's cousin, was welcomed into Prague by the Estates and was proclaimed King Elector of Bohemia. With Bohemia under Wittelsbach control, the electors unanimously voted Charles Albert as emperor. Francis Stephen had lost his right to vote in the election when Charles Albert conquered Bohemia with its electorate status. In view of this dramatic defeat, Maria Theresa displayed an astonishing tenacity, taking the initiative to save her inheritance. Having already won over the Hungarian and Austrian estates, he insisted on a quick campaign against the now Holy Roman Emperor, Charles VII, seizing his dynastic capital of Munich. With Munich captured and the Bavarians cut off from their French allies, Maria Theresa retook Bohemia in 1743. Francis Stephen was elected as Holy Roman Emperor, who was in turn succeeded by his and Mary Theresa's son, Joseph II, of the new Habsburg-Lorraine dynasty. Saxony, meanwhile, had switched sides to support the Austrians, their claim ultimately amounting to nothing. Offsetting this triumph, that same year, 1745, the imperial forces and their British allies met with disaster at the Battle of Fontenoy, the French conquering the Austrian Netherlands, Vendée, Belgium. A British blockade and an unusual act of generosity towards the Austrians caused Louis XV to abandon the conquest. Mary Theresa had saved the Austrian inheritance, save for one notable exception. Prussia had been loyal to the Habsburgs under Friedrich Wilhelm I, King in Prussia. The king had been a constant and genuine supporter of the Pragmatic Sanction, unwilling to wrangle excessive concessions like the British had. Frederick II, his son, had come to the throne in Prussia only a few months prior to the death of the Emperor Charles VI. Frederick II was already set on expansion at Austria's expense, concluding a secret treaty of alliance with France. Frederick laid claim to Austrian Silesia based on an ancient will, Silesia, which was critical for the economic and strategic future of Prussia. Silesia was one of the most densely industrialized and prosperous regions in the Habsburg monarchy, and in the empire as a whole. Silesia had been part of the Habsburg patrimony for centuries, and Maria Theresa rejected Frederick's then preposterous ultimatum to hand over parts of Silesia based on such a weak claim, judging perhaps correctly that if she made any concessions, she would be abdicating her rights to the entire succession. The indivisible succession had been the principal goal of the Pragmatic Sanction, and it was up to her to defend it and enact it. Regardless, Frederick II overran the entire province in a few weeks during the winter of 1741. Maria Theresa had to release the general von Lieperg from prison as she was desperate for competent generals to combat Prussia. Eugene of Savoy had been dead now for 4 years. Nieberg and Frederick II met at Mollwitz, where the Prussian king won his first military victory. The knock-on effect at his Austrian defeats at Mollwitz was to convince Bavaria and France to escalate the War of Succession, convinced of Austrian weakness, Austria having been defeated by what was then considered a second-rate power. The loss of Silesia was confirmed when the Prussians were again victorious at the Battle of Hohenfriedberg. Despite the military disasters of Fontenoy, Mollwitz, and Hohenfriedberg, Mary Theresa had survived in power. She was Holy Roman Empress, the dynasty was secure, and the Habsburg monarchy remained intact, with the major exception of Silesia, for which she quickly began scheming to regain. Throughout it all, she represented a new hope for the rejigged House of Habsburg, now technically the House of Habsburg-Lorraine. I'm reading from a passage from Wheatcroft's book, The Habsburgs Embodying Empire. Maria Theresa's gender prevented her election as Holy Roman Emperor and brought down on her a torrent of foul innuendo. But Maria Theresa transmuted this unalterable fact into her greatest asset. She appealed directly to the loyalty of the Hungarian nobles as their young queen, and legend has her carrying her young son in her arms, an event as mythically fertile as the legend of Rudolf I, the first Habsburg king of the Romans, seizing the crucifix as his scepter. She gained their support and adulation, and some troops, of course. Myth and fact quickly separated, but it was the myth that persisted. Unable to be a traditional Habsburg monarch, Maria Theresa became the mother of her country, Landesmutter, as well as the birth mother of an ever-increasing brood of healthy and attractive children. The elision of the young Archduchess with an image of fecundity had begun prophetically with her birth. The back of the medal commemorating that event shows the new infant apparently emerging from cornucopia amid the fruits of the earth, both held in the arms of her mother, who was dressed in the style of an imperial Roman matron. The legend of the medal reads, "Hope being reborn on earth." Later, the frontpiece to the Histoire Générale de l'Auguste Maison d'Autriche by Jean-Laurent Croft, published in the French edition in Brussels in 1744, shows a plainly pregnant Queen Mary Theresa on her throne, embraced by a youthful prince, Francis Stephen. At the foot of the day, the god and the goddess of war stand guard with shield and sword drawn. The index finger of Bellona points to the gravid empress, indicating where the future of the House of Habsburg lay in the moment of crisis. With this young Queen of Hungary, the emphasis of the Habsburgs shifted discreetly and slowly from being encircled by the replicas of the dead ancestors to being surrounded by the image of the living future of the dynasty, of fertile motherhood, proud paternity, and the joint fruit of their loins. The portrait by Mytens of the son and daughters of Maria Theresa in 1749 shows a painting filled with lively, beautiful children, the three boys dressed in Hungarian style, the four girls in the French style, with Joseph, aged 8, sitting elevated in the centre, holding the collar of the golden fleece, while his elder sister, Maria Anna, fondles the dangling ram. The emphasis on the dynastic emblem, the golden fleece, and the Hungarian costume are dominant themes. The assiduity with which Maria Theresa developed her role as Queen of Hungary was evident everywhere. Shortly after her coronation, the engraver Gottfried Bernhard Gotz depicted her as queen with the caption, "A most devoted Hungary." At her feet knelt a handsome hussar, his hand on his heart and his sword drawn to protect his queen. The sheer profusion of children dominates the numerous paintings of the families of Mary Theresa. The constant fecundity of Mary Theresa gave strength and a sense of the future to the Habsburg domains. She was well known to have remarked immediately after the birth of Joseph, "I wish I were already in the sixth month of a new pregnancy," which was seen as evidence of her implacable determination to defeat all her adversaries on the battlefield. She told her advisers who wanted to make peace with France and Prussia, the two mortal enemies of the Habsburg alliance in 1741, that she would have none of it. The English ambassador, Robinson, described the scene. The ministers, on hearing of the Franco-Prussian alliance, fell back in their chairs, white as corpses, one heart only remaining undaunted, that of the Queen. Later, the ambassador reported that she remarked, "I am only a poor queen, but I have the heart of a king." He, if no one else present, would have recalled the words of Queen Elizabeth I of England, speaking to her army at Tilbury, under threat of invasion by Mary Theresa's ancestor, Philip II, "I know that I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and a king of England too." Even the palace of Schönbrunn reflected the sense of family, as Gordon Brooke Shepherd observed, "Unlike its great architectural and political rivals, Versailles and Potsdam, it remained also a home. Despite its size, there are no fewer than 1,441 rooms in the building, and the sumptuousness of its galleries, its state apartments, something of this domestic aura clings even to the unattended palace of today." Comparing the first design of Fischer von Erlach with the second design, as altered and reduced by Mary Theresa's architect, Bacassi, shows a building, if still not on a domestic scale, far removed from the monster first envisaged during the reign of Leopold. Maria Theresa had come to be considered motherly, partly because of her heroic fertility, but also because she seemed to be so different, so human, in comparison with the public reserve of her father and grandfather. In time, events brought the imperial throne back to the new house of Habsburg-Lorraine, and her son, accompanied by Francis Stephen, was to be crowned King of the Romans. Goethe described the coronation. As her husband, in his odd attire, passed by on the way to the cathedral, exhibiting himself so as to speak as the ghost of Charles the Great, he jested, raising both his hands to draw her attention to the orb and sceptre, and to the quaint gloves he had on, whereupon she burst into an uncontrollable laughter, to the great pleasure and edification of the watching crowd, which was thus privileged to behold the wholesome and unaffected harmony prevailing between the foremost married couple in Christendom. But when the Empress, in salutation to her husband, flourished her handkerchief and shouted her own Vivat, long live, the enthusiasm and rapture of the crowd knew no bounds. Years later, she once rushed into the Imperial Theatre one night, dressed informally to announce to the large audience in quivering tones of excitement, "Our Leopold, her son, has had a son." She spoke with a heavy Viennese accent, laced with argot, writing as forcefully and ungrammatically as she spoke. Francis Stephen never learned to speak German, and French became the language of the court. But his written French was so bad that his wife, no linguist herself, would correct his most glaring errors. In her ease and openness, Mary Theresa apparently anticipated the natural behaviour of the Romantic age. Such appearances are deceptive, for she remained a traditional Habsburg in every respect. She ruled her family with an expectation of absolute obedience. She was a devoted but highly self-conscious mother, and she did not forget that she was also a ruler and the head of her house. She drew up for each child as it left the nest elaborate instructions on religious observance, health precautions, diet, and the duties of his or her station. Lent and other penitential seasons must be strictly kept, and Francis's death solemnly observed, confession and communion must be regular. Only approved books are to be read, and decorous clothes worn. Wives must obey their husbands, nudes and painting ought to be covered up. She wrote to all her children at least once a week, advising, encouraging, and cajoling. She was, as she said, insatiable in the matter of grandchildren, and she showed her daughters and daughters-in-law with constant advice on how to increase their tally if deficient, or how to care for those they had produced. She expected to be obeyed. All the little archdukes and archduchesses received training in some practical skills. Joseph was sent in 1756 to the court printer, Joseph Trattner, to learn the black art. The court connection did Trattner no harm, for within a decade he was a multimillionaire. Some of her daughters became accomplished artists, but they had no choice in the matter. Their mother continued to dictate every move in their lives, even after they had married. She told her youngest and most wayward daughter, Marie Antoinette, Queen of France, that she was not allowed to give up wearing corsets lest she ruin her figure. And she sent spies on many of her children to ensure that they followed her commands, more of them than Marie Antoinette may have felt. I love the Empress, but I'm afraid of her. This is a segment taken from Martin Rady's The Habsburgs. The Treaty of Aachen, which concluded the War of Austrian Succession, was an armistice rather than a peace. Maria Theresa immediately began building new alliances in a vain attempt to compel Frederick II to disgorge Silesia. Hitherto, France had always been the Habsburgs' principal foe. And what he means there is that for roughly 200 years since the reign of Francis I and Charles V, there had been an enduring enmity between Austria, the Habsburgs, and France. You can say that this is the Titanic struggle, the hot war between two great powers, invariably at times involving the Ottomans and involving the British. But the Empress now realized that whatever one might think of France, the King of Prussia is a far more dangerous hereditary enemy to the arch house, the House of Habsburg. She thus backed Count, later Prince Kaunitz, her principal negotiator at Arkham and later first minister, when he recommended in 1749 that she abandon her maritime allies, Britain and the Dutch United Provinces, and seek terms instead with Louis XV of France. The French king was suitably suspicious, but the intervention of his mistress, Madame de Pompadour, and the outbreak of fighting between France and Britain and North America won Louis round to the diplomatic revolution. Typically, however, it was Frederick who broke the peace first. Mistakenly believing that its ruler had joined the coalition against him, Frederick invaded Saxony in 1756, and this was an extension of his new alliance with Britain to defend Hanover. In the Seven Years' War that followed, the Habsburgs should have won. Besides France, Mary Theresa could count on Sweden, Russia, and most of the princes of the Holy Roman Empire, and the Allied armies amounted to 500,000 men, twice the number of troops that Frederick II could muster. But opportunities, including the brief capture of Berlin by Hungarian hussars in 1557, were wasted, for the Empress's generals had been schooled in defensive warfare and held back from carrying the war home to the enemy. So Berlin was abandoned in exchange for a ransom that included 24 pairs of gloves for the Empress, this being the first miracle of Brandenburg. Louis XV, meanwhile, was distracted by British successes in North America and India and pulled resources from the European theatre to fight overseas. But it was the defection in 1762 of her ally Russia that forced Maria Theresa to sue for peace and to accept, once more, Silesia's loss. This being the second miracle of the House of Brandenburg. Emphasis on miracles. The diplomatic revolution ought to have worked. Indeed, I believe if you incorporate the grand scheme of European history from the 16th to the 19th century, France and Austria as two Catholic great powers and dominating the continent should in many senses have proved natural allies. But in the face of such miracles, it seemed that fate and the course of history conspired against Mary Theresa. Kaunitz's diplomatic revolution unintentionally established Britain as the leading global power and confirmed the declining value of French arms, but it brought no benefit to Maria Theresa. Ironically, it was in collaboration with Frederick II that Maria Theresa obtained her most substantial territorial gains. In 1770, she took with Frederick's arguments that the Polish border region of Spiss, and then 2 years later, she joined with Prussia and Russia in the first partition of Poland-Lithuania, to be followed up by two further partitions, as I alluded to in the introduction to this video. The Empress recognized her actions as immoral, and Kaunitz thought them disreputable. But as Frederick himself observed of her, she wept as she took, and the more she wept, the more she took. Indeed, Maria Theresa did better out of the partition than either Frederick II or the Russian Empress Catherine the Great, adding to her realm 2.6 million people and an area of 83,000 square kilometres. By the end of the Empress's reign, the population of her central European lands had reached almost 20 million people, though this obviously to gain Ruthenian and Polish populations at the expense of German populations, further dislodging Austria from her core in Germany and creating for herself an Oriental Eastern Empire, as was perhaps Frederick II's intention to compensate Maria Theresa with Galicia Lodomeria, rather than allow her to reacquire Silesia. Maria Theresa was at war for almost half of her reign. Financial reform and proper husbanding resources were vital to her military survival. Advised by the remarkably capable Count Haugwitz, a man truly sent me by Providence, according to Maria Theresa herself, she upped the tax burden, binding the diets to 10-year agreements so that she no longer needed to bargain annually with them. And she abolished many of the financial functions previously belonging to the diets. When the diets complained, the Empress was tough. To the Quellus Diet of Carniola, which is in modern-day Slovenia, she wrote about taxation. The crown expressly commands you to grant these sums voluntarily. Similarly, in the constitution she gave in 1775 to the parts of Poland Lithuania she had just annexed, now grandly called the Kingdom of Galicia Lodomeria, she denied the Diet any voice in matters of taxation. When money was demanded of them, she explained to the Diet's members that they were not expected to ask whither, but only to consider how. Across Mary Theresa's territories, the Diets withered. Either they were converted into ceremonial institutions, meeting for just a few hours a year, or they became agencies of the central government. Discharging petty administrative duties, checking up on conditions in the countryside, and responding to the plethora of decrees, circulars, and notices that came from the centre. Even the Hungarian Diet languished after 1765, being called neither by Mary Theresa nor by her son and successor, Joseph II, though his anti-Hungarian posture would be far more visceral than Mary Theresa, who I believe was still beloved and enamoured of by the Hungarian population. Politics there moved down a rung to the local country administrations. Although they could be uncooperative, country officials and magistrates generally did what they were told, knowing that too much obstruction could result in the deployment of troops and commissars against them. Hungary may have been the only Habsburg territory where nobles, as opposed to civil servants, still ruled, but they did so with a nervous glance over their shoulders. It was shortly following the Seven Years' War that Mary Theresa's husband, the Holy Roman Emperor Francis Stephen, died, and this is a short segment taken from Wheatcroft. In August of 1765, the court had travelled to Innsbruck to celebrate the marriage of Leopold to the Infanta Maria Luisa of Spain. Francis Stephen had been suffering from pleurisy, and the damp air of Innsbruck made it difficult for him to breathe. What fascinated him in the city was the tomb of Maximilian, the Holy Roman Emperor, which he visited again and again, taking both Joseph and Leopold with him, his two sons. On the 18th of August, returning from the opera, two long and tedious performances, he collapsed by the door to his rooms in the old palace of Maximilian, falling into the arms of his eldest son, Joseph. The seizure was massive, and although his doctors opened his vein and attempted to bleed him, he was already dead. Maria Theresa displayed the kind of grief that had only characterized her ancestor, Juana of Spain. Juana of Spain had taken the corpse of Philip the Handsome and notoriously lived adjacent to the coffin in a tower for the remainder of her life. She had to be taken forcefully, Maria Theresa, from the room where she died, and back in Vienna, she insisted on sewing his shroud herself. From that moment onwards, she wore nothing but deepest mourning, while her apartments and carriages were all draped in black velvet. The rooms that she had shared with Francis Stephen on the first floor of the Hofburg presaged were preserved and never used again. She moved her establishment to the third story. For the remainder of her life, August was always spent in solitude and prayer, and the 18th day of every other month was set to his memory. She cut her hair short and seriously contemplated retiring to an order of nuns which she had founded in Innsbruck. In the years that followed, her grief waned but never disappeared. She put aside memories of his infidelities and occasional boorishness and remembered only his warmth and vivacity. The tomb that she had made for them both, the vault of the Capuchins, had the effigies of Francis Stephen and Maria Theresa, looking for all the world like a loving couple on a rumbled bed. Joseph found his father's will, written in his own handwriting, amid the chaotically organized papers in Francis Stephen's townhouse in Vienna. It reveals that his father's financial speculations had been enormously successful, and he was the sole owner of a private fortune, no longer dependent on his mother for his income. Moreover, as King of the Romans, the heir to the Holy Roman Empire, he automatically succeeded as Holy Roman Emperor. But although his mother, a month after Francis Stephen's death, made him co-regent, She did so without surrendering the whole or any part of our personal sovereignty over our estates, which will continue to be kept, and moreover, without the least actual or apparent breach of the pragmatic sanction. Her inheritance was indivisible. She carries that mantra with her throughout the remainder and the rest of her life. She does not delegate power as a sovereign entirely to Francis Stephen, and she will not renounce that power and now give it over to her son, Joseph II of Austria, Holy Roman Emperor. And despite his voracious character, his indomitability, his reforming zeal, Mary Theresa, the power, the tenacity, and the conviction that she has is such to keep Joseph II constrained as a secondary factor in the politics of the Holy Roman Empire and Austria for 15 years before she finally dies and he can assume absolute power within Austria. She remains the head of the House of Habsburg, now Habsburg-Lorraine, and as Marie Antoinette was fearful of her mother, she would continue to dominate her family. With Kaunitz's failure in the Seven Years' War, Austria, it is clear, would never reattain the heights of glory witnessed under the aegis of the Generalissimo Eugene of Savoy, whose skills had afforded the early reign of Charles VI a fleeting sensation of splendour. In considering the legacy of Maria Theresa as the midwife of the dynasty of Habsburg to Habsburg-Lorraine, I return to the very origins of Habsburg greatness in the 15th century. The Habsburgs did not acquire their empire through feats of military brilliance, but through marriage. Teetering on the edge of extinction, Maria Theresa, as mother of the nation, Landesmutter, and head of the dynasty, was able to inject new life, both literally and in terms of a palpable vitality for the monarchy, a security for its future. She embodied a new form of imperial sovereignty, which no one, including her father, had anticipated, ready to relegate her to the life of a consort. Charles may have devised the pragmatic sanction, but Maria Theresa secured it. She won it. Indeed, in a sense, she was the indivisible realm. She personified the sanction. Moreover, she was perhaps the purest representation of the ancient motto of the House of Habsburg, Alii bella gerunt tu Felix Austria nubi, let others wage war, for you, happy Austria, will marry.